With the death of Joseph Ratzinger, we're going to take a look at his legacy, which included quite a lot of accomplishments. He was a theologian, a priest, became a cardinal archbishop. He is the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. He was a pope. He is a pope emeritus. And so we're going to look at all of that today, at his legacy and what he really left to the world and what he left to the Catholic Church. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before I get started, just encourage people to hit that like button, to subscribe to the channel. Don't hit the notify because you have a life outside of social media. Also, speaking of social media, if you are on it, feel free to follow Crisis Mag. We're on all the major social media channels at Crisis Mag. I would particularly urge people to look at the, to join us on the Crisis channel on Telegram. Sorry, I was hard getting that out. We've been growing that a lot. That's where you can comment on articles, and we're having a lot of good discussions lately. So the Telegram channel on Crisis, you can find the link on our website. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Now, Joseph Ratzinger, a.k.a. Pope Benedict XVI, has left a huge legacy. I mean, I think there's no question about that, that he is one of the most influential churchmen of our time. Because he combined both being obviously the Pope, and a Pope was always going to be influential on the church of his time. But also with that, he was the head of a major Vatican congregation, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, for over 25 years. And he also was a theologian in his own right, a biblical theologian, a theologian who was influential at Vatican II. And there's not a lot of men who could claim all these things. I mean, obviously, John Paul II probably is the most influential churchman of the post-Vatican II era. But I have to say, Joseph Ratzinger, he's right up there with him. I mean, he very much was influential. He rivals JP2's influence. He wasn't the rock star JP2 was. JP2 was obviously the rock star, the one who had the most media attention, things like that. The personality that was just that just flowed over into everything he did. That wasn't Joseph Ratzinger. Yet he did have a huge legacy. And before I really get into it, I just want to mention that at Crisis, we've been running a number of articles about Joseph Ratzinger, about Pope Benedict XVI over the past few days since his death last Saturday. So I'd encourage you to go over to crisismagazine.com and check that out. I mean, he just really is an incredible career. And obviously, in a podcast of this format, I'm not going to be able to go into detail into his career, his legacy. But I do want to talk about some of the highlights and really in the complicated legacy. Here's the thing. I know a lot of people, particularly Crisis readers, have a very fond affinity to him, as do I. But I do think we have to be realistic. We have to have a critical eye at his entire work, his entire legacy, what it really meant to the church. So we're going to do that here. So I think we have to start when we come to Joseph Ratzinger. His first real influence on the church broadly was when he was selected as a theological advisor at Vatican II. This was a position that basically at an ecumenical council, only bishops are obviously invited to come and to vote. But the bishops are allowed to bring theological advisors with them. And these are men who basically, I mean, obviously a bishop isn't necessarily selected because he knows a lot of theology. And so they bring somebody along with them, or maybe a team of people, who would advise them on the various documents and where they're going and how he should look at them. And Joseph Ratzinger was a theological advisor to, it was the Archbishop of Cologne. I can't remember his name now. And so he was there. And now here's the thing. It's well known, people who know Vatican II, the history of it, the theological advisors caused a lot of problems. A lot of the issues that people today have with Vatican II, people like myself even, it's because of the theological advisors. I mean, like I said, most of the bishops aren't theologians. These aren't men who were like, hey, we're going to go in here and change the church or anything like that. But the theological advisors, they were. That's exactly what their intention was. And the truth be told, Joseph Ratzinger was one of them. He was one of the people. He was a reformer. I mean, people like to have this very simplistic view of liberal conservative, maybe even add a traditional as a third category at the council. And so you would put Joseph Ratzinger in the liberal category, but I think that's unfair because I think the reality is much more complex. I think when you come to, when you look at the reformers at Vatican II and in that era, I think there are different types of reformers there. There were some who frankly wanted to overturn the church and make it in a new image. And I think they became much more clear as time went on, somebody like a Hans Kung or somebody like that. But I think there were a lot of sincere reformers who really did think, hey, if we make some tweaks, if we make some changes to how the church is run, to how we present the gospel, we're going to see more conversions. We're going to see a growth of the church. I think a number of people really sincerely believe that. And I think Joseph Ratzinger was one of them. So I think he wanted to make a lot of changes, a lot of reforms in the church against a lot of traditional practices, because he really did believe that this would be the best thing for the church. It would bring the most souls to heaven. And so when we say Ratzinger was a reformer, I don't think we should automatically then say, oh, he was one of the bad guys at Vatican II. I do think some of the things he pushed for, some of the things he did at Vatican II, I mean, it's behind the scenes. Nobody knows exactly everything he did. There's rumors that he helped write this or did that, whatever. But I think in general, though, he definitely was on the side that caused a lot of problems, I think is the best way to put it, at Vatican II. And so that's part of his legacy. I think we who admire him, who look at him as a stalwart of at least conservatism, if not traditionalism, would have to acknowledge that, yeah, part of his life was spent doing some things that didn't help so much, I think. Now, slowly over time after Vatican II, there was a breaking up of a lot of the reform camp, where you had some who just kept going whole hog in that direction of just change everything. That's the Hans Kung camp, that they basically started to question everything. They questioned papal infallibility, everything like that. Ratzinger did not join them. And so people say he became more conservative. I think that's a little bit of a problem as well, because I don't think he changed that much. I think what happened was, is the reform basically just continued down towards its logical conclusion, which was destruction and completely reworking the church in man's image. And I think Ratzinger never wanted to go down that path. The problem, though, here's something I think we have to really grapple with, and the reform of the reform camp needs to grapple with. I'm actually going to have a guest on next week. I think we're going to talk about this. This is the plan. Kind of the differences between the reform of the reform camp and the traditional camp. The reform of the reform camp, obviously Ratzinger is kind of the head of that camp. But I think we have to really grapple with the idea that once these reforms started, it's like the genie was out of the bottle and you can't put it back in. And I think Ratzinger at times, and later as Pope Benedict, he tried to put the genie back in the bottle in a way. And I think that was, I think fundamentally the beginnings of what he did, the reform in the 60s, led to the terrible things that happened, the spirit of Vatican II, which he never endorsed himself, but yet, in hindsight, now I will say in hindsight, because I imagine if I were alive, an adult in the early 60s, I probably would have been in that camp, in the reform camp. I admit it freely. But I think, though, in hindsight, we can see that they opened up a door that probably shouldn't have been opened. And that really was the problem. And Ratzinger then wanted to close it, or at least start to close it later. And the problem is he was involved in opening it. And so although I personally don't think Ratzinger really changed his views over the course of his life, I think he was fundamentally about the same before he died as he was in the 60s. Maybe I think he did season some, started to appreciate some more of tradition than he had before, but essentially was the same. I think, though, that's the error in my mind, the fundamental problem of the reform of the reform camp, of which Ratzinger is, like I said, the main proponent, is that they've let a genie out of the bottle and they're trying to put part of it back in. And I don't think you can do that. Maybe that's a mixed metaphor. I don't know. So anyway, so in the 70s, he becomes an archbishop. He becomes a cardinal. And he then is appointed, I think it's 1981. He's appointed as the prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith under John Paul II. Now, the relationship, the partnership between John Paul II and Cardinal Ratzinger was a very fruitful one, was the dominant partnership, I guess you could say, the dominant personalities of the church in the 80s and 90s. I mean, there's no question about that, that those two men were the most influential men in the church in the 1980s and 1990s. You had Pope John Paul II, the rock star, the personality, the one who's going out there and telling people about the gospel, telling people about the church and presenting this very positive image of the church. And you have Ratzinger, who's in charge of the doctrinal components of the church, making, that's the job of the CDF head, is making sure that basically heresy isn't sprouting in the church. Now, in hindsight, again, if we're being honest, the 80s and 90s were not a good time for the Catholic Church. We saw lots of problem bishops, of which I think you lay at the feet at John Paul II for how he selected bishops, but also just lots of heresy running rampant. I mean, the image, the stereotype of Joseph Ratzinger when he was in charge of the CDF was this, you know, God's Rottweiler, this angry man who was strict with heretics and he would just shut them down. That was not the reality. The fact is that heresy ran rampant throughout the church in the 80s and 90s, still does today, obviously. Now, there were times in which Cardinal Ratzinger did crack down on heretics and did discipline heretics. So it's not like he didn't do anything. I just think we can see in hindsight, he didn't do enough. I mean, there were so many bishops who were saying bad things, priests who were saying bad things, and nothing was done about it. Now, you could argue that that's John Paul. That's not Ratzinger. Maybe Ratzinger wanted to do more, but Pope John Paul II didn't let him do more. So I think ultimately that you can't necessarily say that's all on Ratzinger. It could be more on John Paul II in that situation. But nonetheless, as the head of the CDF, there's no question he had a mixed record because, like I said, he did crack down at times on some more egregious heretics, but at the same time, heresy was running rampant in the church while he was the head of the CDF. And so another aspect of his time as the head of the CDF is that's when the Catechism of the Catholic Church came out. I have it here right behind me, over this way. The Catechism of the Catholic Church was released in the 1990s. Now, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the modern one we're talking about here, it also, I mean, I feel like everything when it comes to Ratzinger, Cardinal Ratzinger, Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, has somewhat of a mixed record. And I think the Catechism does as well. I don't know if people, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when it came out. I just become Catholic when it came out. And I don't think people realize the confusion that existed in catechesis in the church at this time. Younger people who weren't alive at the time. I mean, the 80s and the 70s were a wasteland for catechesis. The catechetical materials were just abysmal. There was no rhyme or, I mean, people just did whatever they wanted. I mean, it was awful. I mean, I know today there's problems, but boy, it was far worse back then. And so when they release a catechism, first of all, just by releasing one, the first universal catechism since the Council of Trent 400 years before, that was a huge deal. And it really did establish that, okay, generally speaking, that catechism is very orthodox. It lays out what the church teaches. And it that was a big deal at the time. And I don't know if people recognize what a big deal it was. And that was, of course, Cardinal Ratzinger was obviously very influential on the catechism as the head of the CDF. He influenced it greatly to make sure it was okay. Now, I will say the catechism of the Catholic Church, I do think has its weaknesses. I do think it has its issues. I'm not even talking about things Pope Francis has been editing it and adding to it recently. I just think the language could be stronger. I mean, a great example that I use actually in my book, Deadly Indifference, is the section on baptism. If you look at the section on baptism in the Council, the Catechism of the Council of Trent, it makes it very clear the necessity of baptism. And it just basically goes a few paragraphs just talking about you need to get baptized. That's the emphasis. In the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the modern one, the section on baptism is, I can't remember now the details, but something like 12 paragraphs. And only one of them, I think, talks about the necessity of baptism. The rest talk about all the kind of exceptions, how people can be saved outside of baptism. Now, I don't think there's anything in that section that's heretical, but I do think the emphasis shift is there, that now all of a sudden we go from a catechism stating, yeah, you need to get baptized, to a catechism that says, okay, you need to get baptized, but if you don't, you're probably okay. You probably have lots of different ways you can get to heaven. And I think for a catechism, remember, this is not a graduate theology class that you'll be taking where you might talk about these different exceptions and you might be discussing them. This is a catechism. It should just state the basics of the faith. So I do think that there are some issues there. And I think this is was part of Cardinal Ratzinger's legacy here, is that things like that did flourish. The emphasis shift from let's stick to the basics of what the church teaches to let's talk about these different ways around it, so to speak, which is the modern way of doing things. And so we see his almost, I think it was 25 years, actually 81 to yeah, so 24 years, I guess, as the head of the CDF. I think his legacy there is mixed as well. His legacy there is mixed because, again, he did do some very good things. It was clear he was Orthodox. It was clear that heretics were not welcome under his watch. Yet at the same time, there wasn't the action taken that probably was needed. Now, I will say in one action he took, he was very involved in the whole situation with Archbishop Lefebvre and the Society of St. Pius X. And that, I mean, that's another legacy there. I mean, I've gone on record that I am sympathetic to Archbishop Lefebvre in a lot of ways, but I do think his actual consecration of the bishops was a wrong action. But that was all under Ratzinger that happened. And you just have to wonder, was there a better way to handle that? Could they have done a better job of handling the Lefebvre situation and the Society of St. Pius X than they did, where it didn't have to end up with excommunications and whatnot? And there's a lot, I mean, the story, if you hear the side of the story from the Lefebvre camp, Ratzinger does not come off good. He comes off as somebody who basically says, oh yeah, we're going to do this. We'll let you ordain bishops. We'll let you ordain bishops, but then never really followed through on it until finally Lefebvre said, forget it. I can't trust you anymore that you're actually going to let me do this. And so again, there's a mixed record as well. So I think his record as the head of CDF, his legacy, a lot of good, but also weaknesses, not really doing as much as probably needed to be done. Okay, so now let's move on. He was obviously elected Pope in 2005. I was ecstatic when he was elected Pope. I was so excited. I love Ratzinger. I'll talk about his writings in a little bit. We haven't even covered his writings as a theologian. I'll talk about that after I go through kind of his career. Now, he was Pope from 2005 to 2013. And one of the things that he was famous for, like to become Pope, was his dictatorship of relativism speech. This was done after Pope John Paul II died, before he was elected, before the conclave. He gave this speech to the cardinals, and it became very famous. And it really was Ratzingering, I guess that's the word. It really was quite a powerful speech, and it really was a great example of how Joseph Ratzinger was able to diagnose the problems in this world in a way that other people were not able to. He really had his finger on saying, here's a problem of modernity. And that was a perfect example of this language of dictatorship of relativism. That the fact is that we're awash in relativism. There is no timeless truth. There are no ways in which we say, yes, this is true, and this is always true, and it always will be true. Instead, it's like, it's your truth and my truth. And we see this with transgenderism today, the lies of transgenderism, this relativism. And Ratzinger saw that very clearly. Now, when he became Pope, I have an article, and I linked to it in the show notes, where I talk about Ratzinger Benedict. And I think, and one of the things I mentioned in there is that I feel like his time as Pope, his 8 years as Pope, there were two specific administrative actions he took, decisions he took, that I feel were the greatest two. The first one was his motu proprio that liberalized the celebration of the traditional Latin Mass, Summorum Pontificum. I felt like that is one of his greatest actions, because he recognized that there was this pent up, maybe even unknown by most people, energy for more traditional liturgy that was being hampered by the rules of the church. And he felt like this is a good thing. It's not bad for young people, particularly, to be attracted to the traditional rites of the church. So he wanted to make it more available to more people. And because, and this is a, it was a very generous, very charitable act. He saw that there was this group on the peripheries, the traditionalists, and I do use that word peripheries somewhat ironically, since our current Pope loves to use it. And so you have these traditionalists, but also there is this desire among non-traditionalists. I don't think this is what people recognize. I think Pope Benedict saw not just that there's these marginalized traditionalists he wants to incorporate into the church, but he also saw that among the conservative Catholics, there was a desire for more traditional liturgy. Maybe it was just in the Novus Ordo, but maybe because they didn't even know about traditional Latin Mass. I mean, I'm one of these people, this fits me perfectly, because when in the early 2000s, I attended a Novus Ordo parish, and I was just, but I wanted to be more and more traditional. I didn't even know what that meant. I'd never gone to a traditional Latin Mass. I didn't even recognize that. But I think Ratzinger did, Pope Benedict. And so that's another reason why he liberalized it, because the celebration of it. He knew people would embrace it. And that's exactly what happened. All of a sudden now, thousands and thousands of people around the world embrace the traditional Latin Mass, which probably wouldn't have if it hadn't been for Pope Benedict. And we can never thank him enough for that. In my mind, that is one of the greatest acts of his pontificate. Probably is the greatest act of his pontificate. I know things have happened since then with Pope Francis. We've talked about that on this channel. But at the same time, we cannot diminish the fact that thousands and thousands of people were introduced to a more traditional liturgy, and just really, they grew in their love of Christ through it. That's the most important part. It's not a matter of like, okay, liturgy wars and all that crap. It's just a matter of people grew in their love of Christ. And that, I believe, is the plumb line of all of Ratzinger Benedict's work, is that he wanted us to have a deeper encounter with Jesus Christ. And he saw that liberalizing the celebration of the traditional Latin Mass would do that. And so I think that's one of his great actions. Now, I think another one of his great, his other great administrative decision was his, when he created the ordinariate, the Anglican ordinariate, whatever you want to call it, where Anglicans would have a formal way to join the Catholic Church as an Anglican parish, a whole parish could. Anglican priests with their congregation could join and become a Catholic parish. And so I think that was another great action of his, because I think, for example, I think ecumenism, I think, I really have come to believe, is one of the great plagues of the Catholic Church in modern times. The ecumenical movement, I should say. Ecumenism itself, I do think there can be some use for it. I've talked about that before. I talk about it in my book. But I think the ecumenical movement, the Catholic Church's involvement with that, has been a disaster from day one, because all it is just a bunch of intellects talking, academics talking around, you know, their cocktail parties about how great each other are. And that's about it. Yet what Ratzinger, Pope Benedict saw when he set up this system, the ordinariate, was this, like, no, we're not just around, ecumenism isn't just about us talking to each other. It's about actually trying to go to the truth, to become Catholic. And that was the beauty of this action of creating the ordinariates. And I think that that was a wonderful thing he did. And I would just say that's a great thing. So that being said, this is becoming a bit of a broken record. I do think his record as a pope was mixed, just like his record as a theologian before he became bishop, his record and head of the CDF, and his record as pope was mixed. What do I mean by that? I believe that, like in a lot of ways, he diagnosed the problems very clearly. He understood them. He explained them very well, but he didn't take the actions necessary to combat the problems when he had the power to do so. Now, I mean, you know, for example, I'm sitting here with a podcast talking about problems. I don't have any power to change most things, but he did. As a head of CDF, as an influential theologian, and as the Pope, obviously, he had the power. And I think in a lot of ways, he did not act on it. One example, again, it's my book, Deadly Indifference, I bring this up. He criticized the Assisi event of 1986, where Pope John Paul II gathered the different world religions together to pray, not together, but in the same place, or however he worded it. But the fact is that he criticized that, Ratzinger did. Yet, when he was Pope, he had an Assisi event himself. It was 2011. And so it's like, okay, you see this issue, it's a problem, but you're not really willing to say, no, we're not going to have the Assisi event. We're not going to have this interreligious dialogue prayer service because I don't think it's a good idea. He didn't think it was a good idea, yet he did one himself. And I think that's the paradox of Joseph Ratzinger, is I think he saw things very clearly, but I don't think necessarily he always had the will or the personality to follow through on it and make the really tough decisions necessary. We also see this with his handling of the Theodore McCarrick situation. I think it obviously became known to him that McCarrick was a problem. And so he basically quietly sidelined McCarrick. And that allowed then Pope Francis to bring him back from his exile, so to speak, and become influential in the church again until it was revealed how much of a monster he was. And I think that a stronger pope, when he realized the problem of McCarrick, he would have been willing to make a more public action, would have been willing to say, you know, we can't have this, especially because remember, this is after 2002. This is after the sex abuse scandal had become public. He would say, you know, we gotta get rid of this guy. He can never have influence in church again. Because although obviously Francis is to blame for bringing McCarrick back into the inner circle, the fact is Benedict is the reason why he was still available to be in the inner circle. If Benedict had laicized him or had really publicly shut him down, that couldn't have happened. So I think that's a case where we see that Benedict understood the problem. He recognized it, but he didn't really completely follow through with the actions necessary to overcome it. Now, obviously, what does this lead to? The papacy, his time as pope, was the great resignation. Resigning, the first pope to resign in, I think it was 800 years since Pope Celestine. I mean, this was just unbelievable that he did. I still think it's unbelievable. To this day, 9 years, almost 10 years later, I still think it's essentially unbelievable that he resigned the papacy. And I think the common narrative is that he recognized that there were wolves in control at the Vatican, that he wasn't really in control. He didn't have the ability to overcome the wolves. So he recognized, in a sense, in humility, listen, I do have a record of not always following through and taking the actions. We need somebody else here who will do that. The problem was this is a fundamental mistake. I feel like this was a fundamental mistake on his part, because if he believed, here's something I haven't seen his defenders and or critics bring up, but if he believed that wolves were in charge of the Vatican, and so he needed to step aside so a stronger pope could come in, why didn't he recognize that those wolves would be very influential at the conclave that would select the next pope? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me, that you would say, okay, very bad influences are rampant at the Vatican. So I know what we'll do. We'll gather all the cardinals at the Vatican. We'll select a new pope to be in charge of them. You're selecting the wolves to select the shepherd. And we see what happened. Exactly what, I mean, we should know would have happened. I think it was just a fundamental mistake of his. Now, I don't think it was like necessarily a sin. I think it was just a mistake he made, where he did not think he had the strength to fight against the evil forces at the Vatican, yet he left it to the Vatican essentially to pick his successor. And I know a conclave isn't just the Vatican, because you have cardinals from around the world, but the fact is that the Vatican has a heavy influence on conclaves. And so I think that we need to recognize that. And I used the word in my article, abandonment, that he was like a father who abandoned his family. And I got some pushback from a lot of people. Now, I want to be very clear. I have a great admiration for Pope Benedict, for Joseph Ratzinger. I talk about this in my article. I love so much about him. I admired him so much, but I just don't think we can get around the fact that he left the sheep with the wolves in charge and he abandoned his post. I mean, people say, well, he was weak. He recognized his weak. He knew he couldn't overcome the problems. Would you say that if a father abandoned his family, let's say I abandoned my family, I say, you know, I just don't have the strength to be a good father, and my kids would be better off if I just left and maybe my wife got remarried to somebody who was better. Would anybody buy that? I hope not. I mean, lots of dads say that. Lots of dads who leave their families say that today, and it's a bunch of horse pucky. It's just nonsense. And so I think the same thing is true here. I think that he might have believed that sincerely, and I do believe that he likely made that decision in prayer and thinking it was the desire of God. But the fact of the matter is he left the wolves in charge. He knew the wolves were in charge, were running the show, and he left. Hoping beyond hope, I guess, that the next pope would be better, would be able to do it. Obviously, we all know he was wrong in that assessment. And so I think that's a big problem. Now, the other thing, so that's one thing. I don't think his record about his resignation is mixed. I think it's all bad, in my opinion. I'm sorry. I don't like to say this. Trust me, I do not like to say that. But there's another aspect of his resignation that is really problematic, and that was how he decided to style himself and to live after his resignation, calling himself Pope Emeritus, dressing in the white papal garments, living in Rome, signing things as Pope, still continuing to have the name Pope Benedict XVI. All these things caused massive confusion in the church. I mean, I've been very clear from day one. I've never believed that he is still the Pope. Never been a Benny Plinus, whatever, Benny Vacantis, whatever you want to call people who believe that. But I do think Benedict shares some of the responsibility for so many people accepting that falsehood, because he brought the confusion on himself by this talk of like he would have a prayerful aspect of the Petrine ministry and he would still be somehow connected to the Bishop of Rome. That's all theological nonsense. When he resigned as Pope, he no longer had any connection to the Pope. The papacy is not a sacrament that you keep your entire life. I don't know if Catholics always understand this. When you are ordained a priest, you're a priest forever. Yes, you can be laicized, in which you are no longer called a priest, but you're still a priest. Same with a bishop. If you're ordained a bishop, you are a bishop for the rest of your life, no matter what. You might, if you resign, you might be a bishop emeritus, but you're still a bishop. That is not true of the papacy. The papacy is not a sacrament. Therefore, if you resign the papacy, you are no longer Pope, full stop. There is no spiritual dimensions. There is no idea of still being connected to the ministry of the Pope, of the Bishop of Rome, all that stuff. I'm sorry, but I know Ratzinger is brilliant. He's a brilliant theologian, so much more brilliant than me that his little pinky is way more brilliant than I'll ever be. But I just feel like it's just nonsense that all that he talked about when it came to the Pope Emeritus was just nonsense. And so I just think it caused a lot of confusion. And I just feel like that was a major mistake. I think what he should have done, I thought this from the day he did it, was he should have got a black priest cassock on, called himself Father Ratzinger, and went and lived in a monastery in Germany and never was heard from again. I think that would have been a lot better off for the church if that had happened. But that's not what happened. And so in the designs and providence of God, that's not what happened. So I just feel like that decision of his to resign the papacy, but then also to basically continue to style himself in a papal way, I think that cast a major shadow on his papacy, on his legacy, on his entire legacy. I don't think there's any way we can say this. Now, I know I'm going long, but frankly, Joseph Ratzinger deserves a whole day of talking about him. I do want to kind of go back a little bit and talk about his writings. Now, he wrote a lot. He wrote from the time in the 1950s all the way until his death, essentially. I mean, until like very recently, he was still writing. And I just want to say that I have always been a huge fan, or as our former president said, a huge fan of Joseph Ratzinger's writings. I've read most of his works that were translated in English. I mentioned the article that I at one point even considered trying to learn German just so I could read all his writings in the original German. But ultimately, I found them very profound. They were very influential on me when I first became Catholic. I went off to graduate studies in theology, and I read a lot of Ratzinger, and I just loved him. I read a lot of the 20th century Catholic theologians, and there was no question in my mind that Ratzinger was the top of the heap. I just felt like the way he said things. And I think particularly, I think his biblical theology is where I really felt like he sang my song. I maybe it was as a former Protestant, he was able to connect with us. I know, for example, Scott Hahn talks a lot about his biblical theology. I highly recommend his book, Communion and Covenant, about the biblical theology of Joseph Ratzinger. He also had a nice tribute in the National Catholic Register this week, Scott Hahn did, about his biblical theology. I can't praise it enough, because what I felt like Joseph Ratzinger did, he was able to use a lot of the modern techniques of scripture study, which a lot of them are used for ill and evil, and a lot of them are just dumb, but he used it in a way that brought in the traditional scriptural interpretation from the patristics, the medieval times, and the modern times. I feel like Joseph Ratzinger was able to bring all of those together into his biblical theology, and I just loved it, and I thought it was great. And I also would say, in comparison to his contemporaries, I mean the 20th century Catholic theologians, he was as orthodox as any of them. I mean, he was more orthodox than most of them. And so I do think that's something in his favor as well. That being said, I wouldn't say this one is as his writings weren't as mixed as I would say his other parts are, but I do think that he was a modern theologian. And I think the good and bad of that. And so I do think there was some aspects of his theology that I do think had some problems. I think, for example, I detail the different types of views of salvation, the role of the church in salvation. And he was an inclusivist, meaning that he did kind of open up the door for people to be saved outside of the Catholic Church. Now, it's Catholic teaching that you can be saved without being baptized, water baptized, through baptism of blood or baptism of desire. That is Catholic teaching going back beyond Aquinas, before Aquinas, to the patristics. That's indisputable. But traditionally, the church has always emphasized water baptism is what we have to go for. And that's what we should be striving for. The other stuff we can't count on. But I do feel like Ratzinger at times, he opened up the door so people might have thought, those people in Africa who have never heard of Jesus Christ, they can be saved through desire. And I think it should be more apt to say, those people in Africa who haven't heard of Jesus Christ, we need to go tell them about Jesus Christ. We need to go tell them about water baptism. And I think some of Joseph Ratzinger's writings helped to bring about, help that foster that whole environment of inclusivism, that we downplay the role of the church in salvation. So I could go more and more on his writing. Actually, I do want to talk about one more thing about his writings. He was very focused on a personal relationship with the person of Jesus Christ, Now, that sounds very Protestant, I know. But that was the beauty of it, is he made that Catholic. He made it okay to be Catholic and say, yes, I have a relationship with the person of Jesus Christ. And in fact, that is the most important thing about my faith. Ratzinger famously talked about how Catholicism is not an ideology. It's not a political system. It is a relationship with the person of Jesus Christ. And I think that was something that Ratzinger was able to do throughout all his writings. As intellectual as he is, as brilliant as he was, it all came back to that. That's one of the reasons I love Jesus of Nazareth, his book he wrote as the Pope, because it really does bring in scholarship and intellect, but yet it's focused on the person of Jesus Christ, because that is the centerpiece of our faith, is the person of Jesus Christ. And I can't praise Joseph Ratzinger enough when it comes to how he presented that need for Catholics to have a relationship with the person of Jesus Christ. So I'm probably going to reread Jesus of Nazareth here soon, because I loved it so much when it came out, and I think it was great. So let me start to wrap up and just talk about his legacy. As you can tell from what I've said, I think that Joseph Ratzinger's had a mixed legacy in the church. I do think on a whole, his work as a theologian, his work as the head of the CDF, Cardinal Archbishop, I do think on a whole that was very good. I think on a whole his time as the Pope was good. I mean, it had some issues, but it was obviously in comparison to the current pontiff, it was incredibly good, but it was good. You know, I on a whole, it was more good than bad. And I think though, when it comes to his resignation and all that's entailed with that, that is the number one bad of his legacy. That is the big taint on his legacy that I don't think you can just wish away. I know some people are like, oh, don't talk about bad things about the dead after they died. I'm not trying to talk about bad things. I'm simply talking about his life. And I think ultimately the results of his decision to resign were far more bad than good. I mean, I think they were only bad, to be honest. That's my opinion. So, like I said, he had a mixed legacy. I think he's one of the great churchmen of our day. I think there's no question about that. And I admire him greatly. I love Joseph Ratzinger, and which is probably why I'm so critical of his resignation. I think if I didn't care that much about him, like I saw some liberal Catholic who was praising him for his resignation because it allowed all these great things to happen. I can see why you would love it for that case. But because I admired him so much and I have such high respect for him, that's probably why I am so much against the resignation, thought it was such a terrible thing. And I also will say, I don't think he should be a canonized saint. This pains me to say this. If you'd asked me 15 years ago, I would have said, absolutely, he should be a doctor of the church. He should be canonized. I don't think that anymore. No, one reason is because, or if he is canonized, it should be a long time from now, at least 100 years from now. One reason is because I think we're canonizing too many popes. I mean, the post-Vatican II church has been one of the worst times in the Catholic Church as far as like people leaving, yet every pope is getting canonized. That makes no sense to me. I mean, the only time every pope ever got canonized was in the early church when it was growing like crazy and we had martyr popes. That made sense. But since then, very few popes have been canonized, rightly so, and I don't think he should be canonized either. And I think because of his mixed legacy, I think because when a pope is canonized, it should be partly because of their job as pope, and he resigned as pope, and that caused a lot of problems. So I don't think he should be canonized, at least not in my lifetime and not maybe in a few lifetimes. So ultimately, I'd say his mixed legacy came down to the fact that he was a great intellect. He was a lover of Jesus Christ. No question about that. But he did not have the personality or maybe the strength to really follow through and take the actions that were needed when he had the power to do them. I think that's ultimately my final my final assessment of his life. So I would encourage everybody to pray for the repose of the soul of Joseph Ratzinger, that he may very soon be face to face with the person that he had such a deep love for, Jesus Christ. And so let's pray for him, offer up masses for him, and fast and pray for the repose of his soul. Maybe if you obtain a plenary indulgence soon, offer it up for him. So I think I'll leave with that. Rest in peace, and Joseph Ratzinger. And like I said, let's just pray for him. Okay, everybody, until next time, God love you.